We'll begin with a few articles out of the American Free Press. Federal Reserve's balance sheet is so out of whack that the central bank would be shut down if subjected to a conventional audit. This is spoken by Jim Grant, editor of Grant's Interest Rate Observer. Quote, if the Fed examiners were set upon the Fed's own documents to pass judgment on the Fed's capability to survive the difficulties it faces in credit, it would shut that institution down, he said. The Fed is undercapitalized in a way that Citicom is undercapitalized. Grant said he would support legislation currently making its way through Congress, calling for an audit of the Fed. That legislation has been brought forth by Congressman Ron Paul for ages, and it looks like it's finally getting some steam. We'll see where it goes. Next item, also from American Free Press. Israelis okay with nuclear Iran. Sure to cause Benjamin Netanyahu and his extremist government heart palpitations, a recent poll reveals that most Israelis could live with a nuclear Iran. According to the stats, only 1 in 5 Israelis believe a nuclear-armed Iran would try and destroy Israel, while 80% of respondents said they expected no change. 11% said they would consider emigrating, and 9% that said they would consider relocating inside Israel. My comment, that's a complete joke. Israel is so small, there's nowhere in the country you'd relocate that would help you in case of a nuclear bombardment. Ridiculous parking fines. Residents of Toledo, Ohio are complaining that they received $25 tickets for parking their vehicles in their own driveways. Mayor Cardi Finkbeiner says he stands by the citations handed out by the Division of Streets, Bridges, and Harbors. He says the tickets were issued under a city law against parking on unpaved surfaces, including gravel driveways. During a news conference, Finkbeiner ignored a reporter's question of whether the crackdown and fines were related to the city's budget crisis. Next one also from American Free Press. America has more recoverable oil than any nation on earth. It's by Pat Shannon. It's been more than a year since Department of Interior announced that North Dakota and Montana have an estimated 3 to 4.3 billion barrels of recoverable oil in an area known as the Bakken Formation, but little is being done about it. The April 2008 U.S. Geological Survey assessment shows a 25-fold increase in the amount of oil that could be recovered compared to the agency's 1995 estimate. New geologic models apply to the Bakken Formation. Advances in drilling and production technologies and recent oil discoveries have resulted in these substantially larger estimates. The USGS Bakken study was undertaken as part of a nationwide project assessing domestic petroleum basins using standardized methodology and protocol as required by the Energy Policy and Conservation Act of 2000. Yet only 105 million barrels of oil have been produced from that formation by the end of 2007. The Bakken Formation estimate is larger than all other current USGS oil assessments of the lower 48 states and is the largest continuous oil accumulation ever assessed by the USGS. A continuous oil accumulation means that the oil resource is dispersed throughout a geologic formation rather than existing as discrete localized occurrences. The next largest continuous oil accumulation in the U.S. is the Austin Chalk of Texas and Louisiana, with an undiscovered estimate of 1 billion barrels of technically recoverable oil. Okay, I have to pause here. I have no idea what they mean by an undiscovered estimate, and they don't explain it. They do explain that technically recoverable oil resources are those producible using current available technology and industry practices. USGS is the only provider of publicly available estimates of undiscovered technically recoverable gas and oil reserves. Quote, it is clear that the Bakken Formation contains a significant amount of oil. The question is how much of that oil is recoverable using today's technology. This spoken by Senator Brian Dorgan of North Dakota. To get an answer to this important question, I requested that the U.S. Geological Survey complete this study, which will provide the up-to-date estimate on the amount of technically recoverable oil resources in that formation. Close quote. Scientists conducted detailed studies in stratigraphy and structural geology and the modeling of petroleum geochemistry. They also combined their findings with exploration and production analysis to determine the undiscovered technically recoverable oil estimates. USGS worked with the North Dakota Geological Survey, a number of Petroleum Institute companies, and independent universities and other experts to develop a geological understanding of the Bakken Formation. These groups provided critical information for models used in the assessment. This sizable find is now the highest producing onshore oil field found in the past 56 years, this said by the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. James Bartus, leading researcher with the study, says America has more oil in this one compact area than the entire Middle East. And the stunning news is that we have more oil inside our borders than all the other proven reserves on Earth, and that could be extracted at approximate cost to Americans of only $16 a barrel. Pat Shannon, writing in the American Free Press. My commentary for today, July 15th. Well, we haven't heard from disgruntled in Peoria in quite some time. Perhaps he's no longer interested in politics, or simply too disgruntled to send in articles. But we have a new source. The following article was sent in by a longtime listener who we shall call Grumpy Old Moose. Why that appellate? Because he is a grumpy old moose. That's why. The article's from some financial newsletter he subscribes to. The author is Puru Saxena, which the moose admits sounds like a brand of cheap dog food, but he says the guy is still worth listening to. It seems to come from a newsletter called The Daily Reckoning. Okay, enough preamble. Here's the article. Coming back to the subject of this essay, the reason that I don't foresee immediate hyperinflation is because the velocity of money is currently weak. In other words, at least for the moment, the private sector in America is not participating in Mr. Bernanke's inflation agenda, despite the fact that Mr. Bernanke has injected a massive amount of reserves into the banking sector. This money is currently sitting as excess reserves within the American banking system. The fact that this money isn't being lent out rules out immediate hyperinflation. However, once the American economy stabilizes and the velocity of money picks up, these excess reserves will trigger a massive inflationary wave. Close quote. By the way, I do encourage listeners to send me short articles on what they feel other listeners should be aware of. It helps if they're short and to the point. I can't be reading lengthy articles that the author has been paid by the word to write. With my short attention span and premature senility, I just can't maintain the attention. Besides, long articles just aren't suited for reading on radio. But do send them in to chamba@kvmr.org. Next item. For those of you who want to see Dick Cheney prosecuted, maybe both. For those of you who want to see Dick Cheney prosecuted for war crimes and want to do something about it, check out credoaction.com. That's credoaction.com. They have a petition you can sign. The petition won't go to Dickie Poo, who doesn't give a chicken scratch what you think, but it will go to Congress critters who have the power, if sufficiently pressured, to put the evil one on trial. That's credoaction.com. Well, comedian Al Franken, next item. Comedian Al Franken is now officially the U.S. Senator from Wisconsin. From Minnesota, sorry. And he's performing his duties as a U.S. Senator. The question I have to raise is, exactly what's the difference between a comedian and most U.S. Senators? Next item. I find that all too often, when I'm at picnics or parties, when the hosts are considerate enough to provide soft drinks for those of us who don't imbibe alcohol, the soft drinks are usually of the light variety. Since most light soft drinks are sweetened with aspartame, I think it's time to take a look at that seeming health benefit. First, I'm going to read you an excerpt from a book. I think the book was called Skinny Bitch. Sunny Sugar is the Devil. The authors were Rory Friedman and Kim Bernoud. Now that you've heard the good news about natural sweeteners, it's time to give up the bad ones. Obviously, refined sugar is bad for you, as is high fructose corn syrup. And in case you had your head up your butt during chapter one of this book, stop eating and drinking products that contain aspartame. This includes diet sodas and sugar-free foods that have NutraSweet or Equal. When aspartame was put before the FDA for approval, it was denied 8 times. G.D. Searle, founder of aspartamine, tried to get FDA approval in 1973. Clearly, he wasn't bothered by reports from neuroscientist Dr. John Olney and researchers Ann Reynolds, hired by Sears himself, that aspartamine was dangerous. Dr. Martha Freeman, a scientist from the FDA Division of Metabolic and Endocrine Drug Products, declared, quote, "The information submitted for review is inadequate to permit a scientific evaluation of clinical safety." Close quote. Freeman recommended that until the safety of aspartamine was proven, marketing the product should not be permitted. Alas, her recommendations were ignored. Somehow in 1974, Searle got approval to use aspartamine in dry foods. However, it wasn't smooth sailing from there. In 1975, the FDA put together a task force to review Searle's testing methods. Task force team leader Philip Brodsky said he, quote, "had never seen anything as bad as Searle's testing," close quote, and called test results, quote, "manipulated." Before aspartamine actually made it into dry foods, only an attorney and consumer advocate, Jim Turner, filed objections against the approval. In 1977, the FDA asked the U.S. Attorney's Office to start grand jury proceedings against Searle for, quote, "knowingly misrepresenting findings and concealing material facts and making false statements in aspartamine safety tests," close quote. Shortly after, the U.S. attorney leading the investigation against Searle was offered a job by the law firm that was representing Searle. Later that same year, he resigned as U.S. attorney and withdrew from the case, delaying the grand jury's investigation. This caused the statute of limitations on the charges to run out, and the investigation was dropped. And he accepted the job with Searle's law firm. Stunning. In 1980, a review by the Public Board of Inquiry set up by the FDA determined that aspartamine should not be approved. The board said it, quote, "not been presented with proof of reasonable certainty that aspartamine is safe for use as a food additive," close quote. In 1981, new FDA Commissioner Arthur Hull Hayes was appointed, despite the fact that 3 out of 6 scientists advised against approval. Hayes decided to overrule the scientific review panel and allow aspartamine into limited dry goods. In 1983, he got it approved for beverages, even though the National Soft Drink Association urged the FDA to deny approval until further testing could be done. That same year, Hayes left the FDA amid charges of impropriety. The Internal Department of Health and Human Services was investigating Hayes for accepting gratuities from FDA-regulated companies. He went to work as a consultant for Searle's public relations firm. Interesting. The FDA finally urged Congress to prosecute Searle for giving the government false or incomplete test results on aspartamine. However, the 2 government attorneys assigned to the case decided not to prosecute. Later, they went to work for the law firm that represented Searle. Fascinating. Despite recognizing 92 different symptoms that result from ingesting aspartamine, the FDA approved it for use without restriction in 1996. Brilliant. So many people have been sickened from this stuff that there are aspartamine victim support groups. Some of the 92 aspartamine side effects listed by the FDA include memory loss, nerve cell damage, migraines, reproductive disorders, mental confusion, brain lesions, blindness, joint pain, Alzheimer's, bloating, nervousness, nervous system disorders, hair loss, food cravings, and weight gain. Aspartamine is a $1 billion industry. The National Justice League has filed a series of lawsuits against food companies using aspartamine, claiming they're poisoning the public. In September 2004, a class action lawsuit was filed for $350 million against NutraSweet and the American Diabetics Association. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld is named in the suit for using political muscle to get aspartamine approved by the FDA. NutraSweet and Equal contain aspartamine. When ingested, one of aspartamine's ingredients, methyl alcohol, converts into formaldehyde, a deadly neurotoxin. In addition to aspartamine, Equal contains the amino acid phenylalanine. Phenylalanine occurs naturally in the brain, but high levels can increase the chance of seizures and lead to depression and schizophrenia. There's no lesser of the two evils. NutraSweet and Equal are both evil. Sweet and Low is no saint either. It's an artificial sweetener that contains saccharin, a coal tar compound. Stay away from it. Because we're having so much fun, let's bash the crap out of Splenda, one of the newest sweeteners. Splenda is made by chlorinating sugar, changing its molecular structure. And then I lost the final page where it tells what's wrong with Splenda. But you have been warned. There was a caller. The caller seems to have hung up. Caller's back on the line. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hi, John Barros in Sacramento. I wasn't the original caller, but I just called in because I wasn't sure if you were talking about a new substance, aspirine, or the old NutraSweet, which is pronounced aspartame.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, A-S-P-A-R-T-A-M-E, aspartame. And I knew about this back when my brother was doing getting his doctorate in physiological psychology at UCSB in Santa Barbara, working with monkeys and chimps and squirrels. And he knew the people who were doing some of the work on animals.
Right.
And he said the methodology is lousy.
Mm-hmm.
And even with the lousy methodology, the findings that they're coming up with are this thing is really, really dangerous. And then he found out, oh, they've stopped the animal studies prematurely, and they're going to let it go.
Uh-huh.
So I knew decades ago that this stuff is like a loose cannon on the population, and it's had its effect.
Yeah. Okay.
So I want you to, if anyone else is hearing and is wondering, oh, is this a new?
No, it's brand new. Same stuff.
It's not. It's the old NutraSweet thing that's been around. Aspartame is how you say it. Chamba,
you're
just great. I really appreciate it. And I'll look for some articles to send you.
Okay? Oh, terrific.
Okay,
thank
bye-bye.
You. Yeah, and thanks for the compliment, even though I can't read and pronounce correctly.
And you got phenylalanine, man. That's a... You did $11 word there.
There you go.
You Chamba.
All right, thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Oh, bye-bye. Okay, now let me see if I can remember where I was at. Aspartame. That's about time I learned to pronounce it. Okay. A couple of more related stories, same subject. New Mexico may be the first state to ban the artificial sweetener some say is carcinogenic. This is out of American Free Press. There's no sugarcoating the message. A growing number of activists and legislators... Oh, let me stop just for a second because I have a vague memory that Donald Rumsfeld was accused of having had stock in Cyril. So he had a direct financial interest in aspartame being allowed into the food supply. Okay, this article. There's no sugarcoating the message. A growing number of activists and legislators in New Mexico are invoking states' rights to ban the FDA-approved artificial sweetener aspartame, which many medical experts contend is a carcinogen that's poisoning Americans. To sweeten the pot, State Senator Gerald Ortiz Pino of Albuquerque recently sponsored legislation prohibiting the sale in the state of all food products and drinks containing the popular chemical sugar substitute, sold under the brand names of NutraSweet and Equal. His legislation maintains that no food containing the sweetener could be manufactured, sold, or delivered in New Mexico starting July 1st, and I do not know where that legislation is, or whether it was approved or not. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hello, Chamba.
Yes.
I have an update on that Donald Rumsfeld connection.
Yes, please.
The actual story is Cyril, the pharmaceutical company that developed this drug,
yes,
was going broke.
Uh-huh.
They were on the ropes, and they brought in a new whiz kid chief executive officer, CEO,
right.
Donald Rumsfeld.
Ah.
Donald Rumsfeld, this was 1979 or 80, Ronald Reagan just being elected.
Mm-hmm.
Rumsfeld announced to the board, I'm going to call in my markers and get aspartame approved.
Wow.
So
did a good job, didn't he?
Yeah. So it had been denied by the FDA.
Right.
Reagan increased the size of the FDA board and stacked it with new members
mm-hmm.
that would make this decision. And over the objections of the scientists who were aware of the neurotoxicity, they approved the drug.
Right. Okay.
So
thanks.
That's Rumsfeld's role. Bye-bye.
That's Rumsfeld's role. And let's tack on a possibility there. As I recall, Ronald Reagan later in life had Alzheimer's.
He did.
And one of the charges is that aspartame can cause Alzheimer's. Wouldn't it be ironic?
Wouldn't it be ironic? Neurotoxicity. Well, you know who else was seen slamming a lot of aspartame sodas?
Who's that?
GW.
Oh,
GW liked to keep a can of it in front of him.
Uh-huh.
And so did the chief executive officer of Enron when he was in the congressional hearings.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's a popular...
Yeah. You know, one of the problems with tracking that story down is it's going to be hard to know if and when GW does contract Alzheimer's. I guess we'll leave it at that, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you for your call. Okay. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Hey, Tom.
Yep.
A little, I hate the pun, additive to
right.
the Donald Rumsfeld thing is there's a film called Sweet Misery out that's all about the aspartame and his role and the whole bit.
Right. Okay.
So if anybody gets a chance to see it, I would highly recommend it.
Uh-huh. And,
all right, thanks a lot.
Okay, you're most welcome. Thanks for calling in. And recommend it even more highly is stay away from aspartame. Stay away from diet sodas and artificial sweeteners. And, you know, if you want to consume less sugar, then just consume less sugar, huh? Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Yeah, one more small footnote on that. Rumsfeld ramrodded the approval of this thing through, even despite the objections of not just other scientists, but the scientists for Cereal Labs.
Oh, really?
His own company scientists. They said, this is dangerous. He went, forget about it. We're doing it.
Well, listen, it's either a question of the health of the people or the corporate bottom line. Get your fat, you know, you got to get your priorities together.
Good show. See ya.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Hey, Jamba.
Yeah.
I wanted to thank you for talking about this issue. This is really a great one. And aspartame was actually approved by presidential order by President Reagan. And he knew that it would take 30 days to get Hayes into the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently that's one of the guys that was for that. And there was a bunch of doctors and toxicologists and people that were against this and objected to it and fought it for like 16 years.
Right.
So apparently what he did was he wrote an executive order making the outgoing FDA commissioner powerless to oppose aspartame. From the congressional record, the Senate page S5497 on May 7th, 1985, it said two FDA officials have told Common Cause magazine that Hayes was determined to push aspartame forward, in part as a signal that the Reagan administration was ushering in a new regulatory era.
They sure did.
Yeah. So I love your comment about Bush and not being able to tell if he was having some sort of problem like that. That's hilarious.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Okay. This will be the last one on aspartame. South Africa's Woolworths removes aspartame. It's by Stephen Fox, writing in opednews.com. Food democracy, the growing trend whereby consumers are flexing their muscles and influencing decisions made by big food retailers and producers, is finding a foothold in South Africa. The first big retailer to pay close attention to what customers are saying is Woolworths. In fact, it's in response to requests from customers that Woolworths has become the first South African retailer to remove aspartame from its foods. It's not the only so-called artificial sweetener to go either. Woolworths has also removed the sweeteners saccharin and cyclamate from its own brand foods. Quote, quite a number of our customers have expressed their concern about these sweeteners. They've let us know that they don't want them in their food. This was explained by Woolworths Food Division Director Julian Novak. Novak also points out that the move is in keeping with Woolworth's good food journey. Minimizing the use of additives in our foods whenever possible is one of our goals, he explains. We started by not using MSG and tartrazine several years ago. Last year, we also took the step of removing added sugar from our fruit nectars, and also in response to concerns amongst consumers. Not only is this the next logical step, we're very pleased to say that we've been able to do it without having any impact on price. This nasty chemical aspartame is made by Ajinomoto, who, since they also make MSG, is the world's largest neurotoxic chemical additive maker. Aspartame's approval was forced onto the market in 1981 by Donald Rumsfeld, at that time with G.D. Searle. in order for him to make $12 to $15 million personal profit. It was next made by Monsanto, and now it's being made by Ajinomoto. So there you have it. If you guys still want to drink diet sodas, go for it. The time's 12:33. The radio station's KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is Chamba Lane. The name of the show, Rabble Rousing. And you are live on the air.
Chamba. Something your listeners might also be interested to know is that aspartame is also in a lot of food products without being labeled. It falls under the heading of natural and artificial flavors.
Really?
Yes. So a lot of the sodas might have it in there because of its addictive property.
Oh my goodness! They wouldn't do that, would they?
Yeah, it's so hard to believe, isn't it?
It certainly is. Well, how would I know if I'm looking at the label on a soda? How do I know if it's aspartame if you say that it doesn't have to tell me it is?
Well, that's just it. You don't.
How neat.
You can't trust, like Michael Pollan says, you can't trust any of the food you see advertised on television.
Wow.
Lovely, huh?
Yeah, terrific situation. So it seems to me that what we really need is some very strong truth in advertising laws where they're forced to reveal actual contents rather than disguising it as natural and artificial flavors.
What, you mean favor the consumer?
Oh, gee, I'm sorry.
It's America.
Yeah. No, I didn't say that. I refuse to be quoted on that. I must have said something else. Okay. Thanks very much for the call.
Bye-bye.
Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Yeah, I have a hunch that the monosodium glutamate is the additive that sneaks in under natural flavors since it's derived from soybeans.
Oh.
Aspartame, I suspect, is a different matter.
Uh-huh. Okay. And it sounds like there's no way to know. But thank you. Okay. Next article is out of truthout.org. It's by Bill Moyers and Michael Winship. It's called Some Choice Words for the Select Few. If you want to know what really matters in Washington, don't go to Capitol Hill for one of those hearings or pay attention to those staged White House town meetings. They're just for show. What really happens, the serious business of Washington, happens in the shadows, out of sight, off the record. Only occasionally, and usually only because somebody high up stumbles, do we get a glimpse of just how pervasive the corruption has become. Case in point. Catherine Weymouth, the publisher of the Washington Post, one of the most powerful people in D.C., invited top officials from the White House, the Cabinet, and Congress to her home for an intimate, off-the-record dinner to discuss health care reform with some of her reporters and editors covering the story. But CEOs and lobbyists from the health care industry were invited too, provided they forked over $25,000 a head, or up to $250,000 if they want to sponsor a whole series of these cozy get-togethers. And what's the inducement offered? Nothing less, the invitation read, than, quote, an exclusive opportunity to participate in the health care reform debate amongst the select few who will get it done, close quote. The invitation reminds the CEOs and lobbyists that they'll be buying access to, quote, that those powerful few in business and policymaking who were forwarding, legislating, and reporting on the issue. Spirited? Yeah. Confrontational? Nope. The invitation promises this private, intimate, and off-the-record dinner is an extension of the Washington Post brand of journalistic inquiry into the issues, a unique opportunity for stakeholders to hear and be heard. Let that sink in. In this case, the stakeholders in health care reform do not include the rabble, the folks across the country who actually need quality health care but can't afford it. If any of them showed up at the door, kitchen door, on the night of this little soiree, the bouncer would kick them beyond the beltway. No. Before you can cross the threshold to reach the select few who will actually get it done, you must first cross the palm of some outstretched hand. The Washington Post dinner was canceled after a copy of the invite was leaked onto the website, politico.com, by a healthcare lobbyist of all people. The paper said it was a misunderstanding, The document was a draft that had been mailed out prematurely by its marketing department. There is noblesse oblige for you. Blame it on the hired help. In any case, it was enough to give us a glimpse into how things really work in Washington, a clear insight into why there's such a great disconnect between democracy and government today, between Washington and the rest of the country. According to one poll after another, a majority of Americans not only want a public option in health care, they also think that growing inequality is bad for the country, that corporations have too much power over policy, that money in politics is the root of all evil, that working families and poor communities need and deserve public support if the market system fails to generate shared prosperity. But when the insiders in Washington have finished tearing worthy intentions apart and devouring flesh from bone, none of these reforms happens. Oh, they say, it's about compromise, all in the spirit of a give-and-take negotiating of a representative democracy. That, people, is BS. The basic nutrient of Washington's high and mighty. It's not about compromise. It's not about what the public wants. It's about money, the golden ticket to the select few who actually get it done. When Congress passed Helping Families Save Their Homes Act, the select few made sure it no longer contained the crammed-down provision that would have allowed judges to readjust mortgages. The one provision that would have helped homeowners the most was removed in favor of an industry that pours hundreds of billions into political campaigns. So, too, with a bill designed to protect us from terrorist attacks on chemical plants, with a select few dictating marching orders, hundreds of factories are being exempted from measures that would make them spend money to prevent the release of toxic clouds that could kill hundreds of thousands. Everyone knows the credit ratings agencies were co-conspirators with Wall Street in the shameful wilding that brought on the financial meltdown. But when the Obama administration came up with new reforms to prevent another crisis, the credit ratings agencies were given a pass. They'd been excused by the select few who actually get it done. And by the time an energy bill emerged from the House of Representatives the other day, the select few who actually get it done had given away billions of dollars worth of emission permits and offsets. As the New York Times reported, while the legislation worked its way to the House floor, it grew fat with compromises, carve-outs, concessions, and out-and-out gifts, expanding from 648 pages to 1,400 pages as it spread its largesse amongst big oil and gas, utility companies, and agribusiness. This week, the public interest group Common Cause and the Center for Responsive Politics reported that, quote, according to lobby disclosures reports, 34 energy companies registered in the first quarter of 2009 to lobby Congress around the American Clean Energy and Security Act of 2009. This group of companies spent a total of $23.7 million, or $260,000 a day, lobbying members of Congress in January, February, and March. Many of these same companies also made large contributions to the members of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, which has jurisdiction over the legislation, and held a hearing this week on the proposed cap-and-trade system energy companies are fighting. Data shows oil and gas companies, mining companies, and electric utilities combined have given more than $2 million just to the 19 members of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee since 2007, the start of the last full election cycle. It's happening to health care as well. Even the pro-business magazine The Economist says America has the worst system in the developed world, controlled by executives who are not held to account, and investors whose primary goal is raising share price and increasing profit, while wasting $450 billion in redundant administrative costs and leaving nearly 50 million uninsured. Enter the select few who actually get it done. Three out of four of the big health care firms lobbying on Capitol Hill have former members of Congress or government staff members on the payroll. More than 350 of them, and they're all fighting hard to prevent a public option at a rate in excess of $1.4 million a day. Health care policy has become insider heaven. Even Nancy Ann DeParle, the White House health reform director, served on the boards of several major health care corporations. President Obama has pushed hard for a public option, but many fear he's wavering. And just this week, his chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, the insider Dattuti insiders, indicated that a public plan just might be negotiable, ready for re-engineering, no doubt by the select few who actually get it done. That's how it works, folks, and it works that way because we let it. The game goes on and the insiders keep dealing themselves winning hands. Nothing will change, nothing, until the money lenders are tossed out of the temple, the ATMs are wrested from the marble halls, and we tear down the sign they've placed on government, the one that reads, "For Sale." That was written by Bill Moyers and Michael Winship in truthout.org. Okay, let's do something local. The times, they are a-changing. Tuesday's column by Jeff Ackerman, publisher of Grass Valley Union. Pot shop debate is a case of smoke and mirrors. A friend suggested Grass Valley would be a better place to open Western Nevada County's first marijuana dispensary. I knew a guy whose last name was Potts, and he lived on High Street, he told me. We all got a good laugh until I realized he was serious. National sports commentators had fun with Grass Valley not long ago when professional football player Ricky Williams was visiting a yoga farm here after leaving football because they wouldn't let him smoke pot. He soon realized that yoga and pot didn't pay nearly as much as professional football, so he dropped the pipe and returned to the Miami Dolphins, where many of his teammates were probably shooting steroids through their butt pads and foreheads. I bring this up as Nevada City, which some say is Grass Valley's contrary sister, studies the notion of opening a medical marijuana dispensary. A fellow named Harry Bennett, who reportedly has a doctor's note that allows him to consume marijuana, has asked the city if he can open a shop, much like the one up in Colfax. So we sent a reporter up there to check it out and discovered it's quite the well-run operation that seems to be doing everything it's supposed to do by way of rules and regulations. Maybe that's why the mayor of Colfax told us there have been no problems with the business. Nevada County City Council is doing a thorough job studying the issue in an effort to craft an ordinance that will ensure safeguards are in place should they allow the dispensary to open. Police Chief Lou Trovato and a couple of councilwomen even visited the Colfax shop on a fact-finding tour. They didn't see drug addicts sleeping on the sidewalks, didn't get robbed, and nobody offered them sex in exchange for drug money. The business was very much like a drugstore, complete with candy bars, cookies, and brownies. And, by the way, they sell painkillers at drugstores, and I don't see pill poppers hanging out in the parking lots of Long's. They go in, get their pills, and go home. That's one of the reasons they ought to allow someone to open a dispensary. The fellow in Colfax is also in the running to open one here, in Nevada City and or Grass Valley. For starters, they already sell pot in Nevada City and Grass Valley. If you were looking to buy some, it might take you 10 minutes to find someone willing to sell you some. That's the way it's been for probably the last 40 years or so, ever since a fellow named Puck, no last name, came up here from the Haight-Ashbury in 1969, spilled some seeds on the ground near his North San Juan domed hut, came out the next morning and saw 10-foot plants. He called a few friends, and they've been farming ever since, much to the displeasure of honest-working vodka drinkers. In fact, marijuana is Nevada County's number one cash crop today, which may be the only thing propping up our fragile economy. The problem is nobody's getting any tax money, and we're spending a whole lot of taxpayer dollars, what little is left, trying to find and burn marijuana. The sheriff's office budget has been untouched by budget cuts. Maybe that's why my friend who worked for the Yuba County District Attorney's Office thinks it may be time to decriminalize drugs altogether. He prosecutes most of the gang-related violent crime and says drugs are the lifeblood of that activity. Decriminalize the drugs and the gang's tax-free empires may crumble, or at least leave them to kidnapping, prostitution, perhaps Kool-Aid stands. If that doesn't get your attention, maybe the fact that our state is spending more to house criminals than to educate students. At a time when California is in the midst of a budget impasse and a $26 billion deficit, the State Department of Corrections made an estimated 2,000 new hires since May. And you thought there was a hiring freeze? It even hired two Muslim ministers at around $45,000 each. We spend $10 billion per year to keep the state's estimated 170,000 inmates, many of them in prison for drug-related crimes, beyond bars. That doesn't include the $200 million or so we spend each year on their medical care, which was why more than 70,000 people work for that department. By the way, did you know that a prison psychiatrist makes $249,000 a year? A guy named Wes just landed that gig, according to my latest edition of Capital Weekly, which lists all the state's new hires, complete with names and salaries. Don't read it on an empty stomach. I learned once that the definition of insanity was doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. Perhaps it's time to try a new approach when it comes to drugs and drug enforcement. So far, it's too tough to tell the winners from the losers. That was Jeff Ackerman, the publisher of the Grass Valley Union, writing in the Union. And those of you that have lived in Nevada County for a while will realize that the Grass Valley Union, our main newspaper, has certainly changed its tune regarding cannabis and cannabis clubs. How far behind can the rest of can government be? We shall see. Should I read this? Nah. The Looming War on Bloggers by Kevin Gristola, opednews.com. Are bloggers really just eyeballs with no insight, or digital dickweeds? Those who run the gigantic news corporations, the accredited news organizations, those who are members of the press, gaggle that far too. Often choose access over practicing investigative journalism. Those who control and work in the media with which we get the majority of our information on news and current events. Okay. Somehow this printing got screwed up. That makes no sense the way it's typed out. Those in the Rupert Murdoch empire have been watching closely and have been trying to sow the seeds of internet news so that people will be prepared to buy news. Murdoch and company would like it so that bloggers like you and me have to pay a premium for information, and then it would be less possible for us to argue for and against an issue. Pursuing an agenda for a cause or against an individual would be more difficult. John Hartigan, CEO for News Limited, which Raw Story reports is a cog in the Rupert Murdoch empire, responsible for the publication of more than 50 newspapers in Australia, appeared before the National Press Club in Canberra to argue that the newspaper business will adapt and survive. Hartigan quoted Andrew Keane, author of The Cult of the Amateur, saying, "Citizen journalists," he says, "are simply don't have the resources to bring us reliable news. They lack not only expertise and training, but access to decision-makers and reliable sources." Keane's quote and Hartigan's arguments would be more valid if The Australian, a national newspaper that Hartigan's own News Limited owns, wasn't publishing articles that, in the midst of the Iranian regime's crackdown on journalists and media, imply and suggest that Iranians are providing reliable news to news organizations around the world. For example, in an article, "Citizen Journalism Arises from Media Rubble," how Iranians have used Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and CNN's iReport is highlighted. The Australian's Middle East correspondent, John Lyons, is quoted saying, "Citizen journalism has its shortcomings, but in the Iran uprising it is shown as a net benefit." Despite the fact that the article includes portions that urge caution when relying on citizen journalism for accurate information, it would seem that most often what is gained from those in the midst of the news, which is unfolding or telling it like it is. After all, what's the incentive to lie? Hartigan believes that the difference between professionals and amateurs is that bloggers don't go to jail for their work. They simply aren't held accountable like real reporters. Let me interrupt here. If you have a, quote, real reporter that's actually being paid by the government, they're never prosecuted. They can falsify as much as they want. They can just relay government propaganda as if it's news, and nothing ever happens to them. Back to the article. Interestingly enough, his own newspaper in the same article cited above proves his assertion to be foolishly wrong. It acknowledges how Iran currently surpasses China in the number of journalists and web bloggers behind bars. Obviously, those bloggers have, contrary to Hartigan's belief, gone to jail for their work. Additionally, Raw Story points out bloggers have been jailed for various reasons. True, bloggers will not go to jail for libel, most likely. But how many bloggers do you know who have a successful operation which primarily consists of smearing individuals and politics in the news media? Well, the Drudge Report, maybe. Hardigan, forgetting who he is, owned by, and who his associates are, accused bloggers and a large number of comment sites of practicing political extremism and personal vilification in the midst of offering his own personal vilification of bloggers. Like Keating's famous, "All tip and no iceberg." It could be said that the blog sphere is all eyeballs and no insight. Okay, I've got a caller. You're going to have to wait. I've got another page to read here. As Robert Thompson of the Wall Street Journal says, the blogs and comment sites are basically editorial echo chambers rather than centers of creation. And their cynicism about so-called traditional media is only matched by their opportunism in exploiting it. One of the best-known comment sites in Australia matches that identikit. It started as a moralizing soapbox boasting about its lack of standards. Positioned as an underdog, it lectures mainstream media every day. In the blogosphere, of course, the mainstream media is always found wanting. It really is time this myth was blown apart. Blogs, and a large number of comment sites, specialize in political extremism and personal vilification. Radical, sweeping statements, unsubstantiated with evidence, are common. One Australian blogger who shoots first and checks facts later is proud to boast that his site is not wrong for long. Mainstream media understands most of the time that comment and opinion is legitimized by evidence. Opinions, however strongly held, draw their legitimacy from the factual accuracy that underpins them. Many of these sites and bloggers say their radical new approach is a modern form of participatory democracy. But as Andrew Keene says, amateur journalism trivializes and corrupts serious debate. It degenerates democracy into mob rule and rumor milling. Most online news and comment sites don't generate enough revenue to pay for good journalism. Good journalism is expensive. I challenge Hardigan's belief that bloggers with readers do not regularly source their opinions when offering them. Based on expertise, on experience, the more sources, the more likely it is that readers will care about and consider what you have to say. I also challenge Keene's argument that bloggers degenerate democracy into mob rule and rumor milling. I've monitored comment section, which seem to get closer and closer to the truth as more and more people comment. Ultimately, those who are trivial and nonsensical lose out to those committed to truth and intelligent debate. You finally get good journalism. Good journalism may be expensive, but there exist many possibilities for those who wish to file reports on shoestring budgets. You don't have to have millions to share with others what it was like to participate in an anti-war rally in March, what it was like to be at the inauguration, how a hearing or town hall on health care went, etc. A person can call up sources and conduct interviews. Of course, it helps to affiliate yourself with an organization, but just saying you're an internet news writer and asking for some information to put together an article can yield very good results. Hardigan's lecture comes just over a week after Nico Pitney of the Huffington Post was heavily vilified by Washington Post's Dana Milbank and other members of the press corps for being able to ask a question to Obama at a press conference. The anger, of course, stemmed from the fact that Pitney was a blogger for a left-wing internet news site, and he got to ask his question before others, who normally would have been called on before any bloggers would. It also comes a day after CNBC host Dennis Neal called bloggers digital dickweeds and went on a tirade against financial bloggers who didn't think that the recession is over. The terrain is shifting. Bloggers are getting better and better at what they do. They're becoming more professional and choosing to be less amateurish in the way they present news and information. The rise of citizen journalism has occurred because of media organizations' failures to report real news. News citizens need to make proper decisions in our democracy and in our world. Media organizations are running scared, and so they should. Okay, nearly out of time. We'll end with this fascinating news report. When Grandma goes to court. In a trial, a southern small town prosecuting attorney called his first witness, a grandmotherly elderly woman, to the stand. He approached her and asked, "Mrs. Jones, do you know me?" She responded, "Why, yes, I do know you, Mr. Williams. I've known you since you were a boy, and frankly, you've been a big disappointment to me." "You lie. You cheat on your wife, and you manipulate people and talk about them behind their backs. You think you're a big shot when you haven't the brains to realize you'll never amount to anything more than a two-bit paper pusher. Yes, I know you. The lawyer was stunned. Not knowing what else to do, he pointed across the room and asked, Mrs. Jones, do you know the defense attorney? She again replied, Why, yes, I do. I've known Mr. Bradley since he was a youngster, too. He's lazy, bigoted, and he has a drinking problem. He can't build a normal relationship with anyone, and his law practice is one of the worst in the entire state. Not to mention, he cheated on his wife with three different women. One of them was your wife. Yes, I know him, too. The defense attorney nearly died. The judge asked both counselors to approach the bench, and in a very quiet voice said, If either of you idiots asks her if she knows me, I'll send you both to the electric chair. Okay, that's it for today.